Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Red alert, everyone. Red alert. This is Jordan Hoffman, host of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, with a special programming note. The episode you're about to listen to was recorded with the intention of being released on Wednesday, July 20th, which was the original review embargo date for Star Trek Beyond set by Paramount. We recorded this episode on the 14th so that we'd have it ready to go for the embargo lift on the 20th. And then something funny happened. Paramount said, "Hey, guess what? Everybody seems to like this movie. You all can release your reviews tomorrow." So, which is a good sign. I think you're going to learn a lot more about what I thought and what my three guests, the three notable film critics that make up our roundtable, think in a moment. The only reason I'm bringing this up is that in the recording, I say things like the movie which comes out tomorrow. And if you're listening to this very early, like the day this podcast gets released, that is a fib. That is a lie. But we didn't have the time or energy to go back and change every line. So with that, the spoiler alerts are up even higher, because if you want to watch the movie unspoiled, instead of just waiting a day, you now have to wait a week. But this podcast is meant to live on in perpetuity, and that's what it's going to do. Okay. I think everyone's got that. I think it all makes sense. I think it's now time to listen to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, with a special critics roundtable discussing Star Trek Beyond.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
Engage.
Engage. Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Holy cow, we're back. We're back for another week of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. We have a big episode. We are packed. We are beyond packed. We are Star Trek beyond packed. This is an episode in which we will discuss, finally, the third film in the Kelvin timeline, Justin Lin's Star Trek Beyond, which I have seen. It is. We're recording this today, July 14th. 2016. I saw the movie last night, and we're unleashing this episode the day of the embargo break for critical reviews, which means you can go see it tonight in a theater. It's playing sneak peek marathons tonight, and then it's in theaters this weekend, and then it's out in the world. So what I'm getting at is this is not a spoiler light zone. This is a spoiler heavy zone. We're going to talk spoilers. Although, if this is not a movie that has a lot of spoilers in it, there's only one cool thing at the end, which I didn't see coming, which will make a hardcore Star Trek fan weep. Maybe we'll get into that later. So this episode is going to be fun because, as you know, one cannot pay the rent by merely being the host of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. By trade, I am a film critic, and I write for outlets like The Guardian and elsewhere, and I have recused myself from reviewing Star Trek Beyond. I'm too close to the material. It's difficult for me to speak, common sense about Star Trek. I like it too much. So I'm not reviewing it. But what we're going to get on the podcast today are three critics who will be. And that's going to be happening in a little bit. But before we get to that, I wanted to touch upon very quickly last week's show. If you listened to last week's show about the Star Trek The Motion Picture, my friend and colleague Matt Singer was on, and Matt Singer mocked me, guffawed, looked me in the eye, and laughed when I told him that when I was a young lad watching Next Generation, it never dawned on me that Wesley Crusher was a nerd or that Wesley Crusher wasn't cool. I'm not going to say I idolized Wesley Crusher, but he was a part of the crew, and he was a kid, and he was a genius, and that was great. Isolinear chips. But then later in life, I discovered that many people hated Wesley Crusher. So I confessed this, and he laughed at me like a bully. But I got an email this morning from a listener by the name of Dwayne. And Dwayne writes, "Mr. Hoffman, I'll try to keep this brief because it is too long to tweet. I wanted to say thank you for putting into words how I felt about Wesley Crusher on the Star Trek The Motion Picture episode of Engage. As a young kid when TNG debuted, I never realized anyone had a bad thing to say about Wesley. He was, and in some ways still is, my hero, and a huge influence on my decision to follow science and engineering in my studies and career. The fact that there were people who were annoyed by him or even hated him never crossed my mind until much later when I started encountering other Star Trek fans online in the 90s. Hearing that there is someone else out there who had the same reaction to him was very validating." See? So there's somebody else. Dwayne. I don't know where Dwayne is from, but Dwayne says this also. "Also, congratulations on the show. It's been a treat. And Matt Singer sucks." No, he didn't say that. I'm making that part up. So there you go. Hats off to you, Wesley Crusher. We love you. We love your rainbow sweater. We also love Red Alert. I'm here to say that I've seen Star Trek Beyond, and I love it. It's great. It's not perfect. It has pretty much one big problem, but the pros certainly outweigh the cons, and it's such a course correction over Star Trek Into Darkness. Star Trek Into Darkness, which is the way I put it like this, like I always am up for watching old Star Trek and old Star Trek movies. Star Trek Into Darkness, I still kind of like, but like I'm never itching to watch it again. It's just kind of bleak. It's just, it's just complicated and kind of bleak. But I love the 2009 movie, and I love this one. And I almost feel like if you watch the 2009 Star Trek and then watch this and just kind of put Star Trek Into Darkness kind of away, it's fine. It's not a trilogy, it's a diptych. And this movie is terrific, and it's a really great blend of the humor and clever script writing of Simon Pegg, which you might be familiar with from his screenplays he co-wrote with Edgar Wright for the Nick Frost collaborations. They're called Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. There's a lot of those sort of clever, I almost want to call them montage-y type sequences. And then it's directed by Justin Lin. And although, the Fast and Furious movies have their detractors as well as their fans, one cannot deny that he has a great deal of visual panache and style. And it works. It's a good blend for me. Star Trek, and Matt Singer said this last week, Star Trek is very malleable. I mean, it's a franchise that can have, deep ethical conversations on Deep Space Nine. It can have kind of slow, almost like trippy head films like The Motion Picture. And it's going to have fun action like Star Trek Beyond. This is a fun movie. And there are action sequences that are a little bit silly that rely a little bit on gags. It's not like goofy. But some fans are going to think it's too far. I'm going to talk about that more when we get our guests in. But some fans, I know some of the fans. I know you people. I'm one of you. So I can think with the hats of different fans while I'm watching the show. I know some fans are just going to say, it's too much, I can't handle it. And that's okay. I mean, that's fine. That's you do you. I'm not going to force this movie on you. And I get it. And you're right. There's a moment where Uhura says, we're going to kick a little ass in this movie. And Prime Uhura doesn't talk like that. I know. But this is a different Uhura. It's a different time. you know, just take it easy, you know. you gotta choose your battles in life. So this Uhura says kick a little ass. There's something else, like Scotty calls Captain Kirk a beautiful bastard. Even though there is a great camaraderie between Scotty and Captain Kirk in the original series, the prime Scotty would never call the captain a beautiful bastard. That's just too informal. But it happens in this movie. So mentally prepare yourself for that. And if you do, and if you can accept the fact that, like, they get the baddies in kind of a goofy way that involves something kind of silly, then, you know, you're going to like the movie. I really liked it. I was nervous going in because I was worried. I didn't particularly care for Star Trek Beyond. Star Trek Into Darkness, but I like this. All right, so that's my sort of take on it. And also, for the hardcore Star Trek fans, there's some cool... There's a reference to Cat's Paw. There's a reference to cool deep cut stuff from Enterprise, which is great because that's the shared... part of the shared timeline. Also, they call escape pods in this movie Kelvin pods, which is great because when the Kelvin was destroyed, they all leave out in shuttles and be like, oh, if they had escape pods, it probably would have been more lives would have been saved. So now they're called Kelvin pods when they have to escape. So there's some cool stuff in there that I'm going to see the movie again very, very soon. And I'm sure I'm going to pick up on a lot of that. All right. So that's my preamble. We're going to bring in our guests and be right back.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
All right, and we're back. This is exciting. I'm now going to beam in our guests. I'm going to beam in three in a row. I hope the engineering room can handle in a three-person beam. And... whoa! Look at that! They're materializing before us. We have three of New York City's finest film critics here on Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, up here on Deck 44. I am going to introduce the three of them in the order of who is the most inherently Star Trek fan to the least to the most. And last night I was trying to think of the three of you, who was the Kirk, who was the Spock, who was the Bones. I was talking to Bilge about this, and you're all Bones. Which is good. That's a
We're
compliment.
All Bones?
You're all Bones.
I feel like this could go so wrong.
Damn it, Jordan, I'm a film critic, not a doctor.
Yeah, there you go. You're all Bones. Congratulations. Okay, so first, we have Allison Wilmore, who is the chief film critic at BuzzFeed.
The only film critic at BuzzFeed. Chief by default.
The only critic at film BuzzFeed.com. Prior to her work at BuzzFeed, she was working at IndieWire. And before that, you were working on the IFC channel.
I was. That's correct.
And before that...
I was floating out in the world.
Were you? Did you work
before
at like
I a, made this doomed career choice?
Were you working at a bar or something, or a hamburger stand?
I was
or?
In college.
You were in college. Okay. Yeah. Did you ever work in a restaurant?
I worked at a bakery.
Oh,
once. I would work the 3 a.m. to 10 a.m. shift.
No
it
joke.
It was great. It was actually one of the best jobs I've ever had.
Where was this?
In Danville, California.
Nice. You made bread.
I did. I made bread.
You were the yeast.
Take a break at 6 a.m. Watch the sunrise. Have some fresh bread.
Hey.
It was great.
Not too shabby. Okay, Allison, I'm introducing you first because you were very frank about this. You said that you did watch The Next Generation when you were a young lass.
Yes.
You've never seen an episode of the original series.
That's correct.
You've certainly never seen Deep Space Nine, Voyager, any of that.
I think I've probably seen one or two episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
Do you know what Deep Space Nine is? Do you know what Deep Space Nine...
Isn't that the place they are?
Yeah.
Yeah. The place they
See?
Are.
See? You know, she knows. That's well, you know
was
things.
There like a trick to that?
No.
I don't know. That was so like,
it's not conniving.
Fooled you. Actually,
I thought he was about to lay down some nerd science there.
So, And you've seen most of the films, probably all of them, but maybe you skipped one or two.
I would say maybe half of the films.
Okay.
I've seen all three of the new films.
Of the new film. The Kelvin timeline is now called.
Okay.
And by the way, I confirmed what we heard. Those are called Kelvin pods.
We'll get there. We'll get there. But that I yelped out loud.
Yeah, you know, that was exciting. Okay, we haven't introduced you yet, so we don't know that other voice.
You're not here yet.
So that is Allison Wilmore. She's a wonderful person. She writes for BuzzFeed. She's brilliant, and she's here on the show.
medium-style Star Trek fan. Bilge Ibire is here. Bilge is the chief film critic?
I'm one of two main film critics.
Okay. I like making people chiefs. You know, I'm very... It's like Star Trek. I like having people having, you know, ranking. At the Village Voice, you can read his work on villagevoice.com. If you live in the New York City area, you can go to one of the ubiquitous red boxes and read it in print.
You can also get a subscription.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You can live anywhere in America and get a subscription to the Village Voice?
I believe you can live anywhere in America and get a subscription to the Village Voice. You might even be able to live anywhere in the world and get a
subscription.
Holy cow.
Look at that. Well, that's cool. And your work is syndicated in other papers, LA Weekly and...
It is, to some extent. It's a little complicated. The Village Voice used to be owned by the same company that also owned the LA Weekly and a number of other alt-weeklies around the country. The Village Voice is now actually independently owned, but we still have this content sharing partnership. So a lot of my reviews wind up in LA Weekly, and then LA Weekly's film critic, her reviews wind
this
up in
Village
Voice.
This sounds like the sharing of the Star Trek brand between Paramount and CBS after the split of Viacom.
That's exactly what it's like, Jordan.
Awesome. Cool. So Bilge tells me, Bilge, I never know how to pronounce your name.
It's anything is fine. I go by Bilge when I'm in the U.S. Oh. And in Turkey, it's pronounced Bilge, but...
You know, did you ever know that?
He has told me that
you
before.
You should go for that, Jordan.
Bilge. Is it embarrassing when I do it?
No, it's not. It's just that it's I call myself Bilge.
So okay, fair enough. Bilge tells me that when he was a young lad, he loved the original series, watched it incessantly, but then after that, never checked in with Star Trek again, has never seen Next Generation, and has seen some of the movies, maybe?
I've seen all the movies, I think.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I've seen all the movies. I mean, I saw all the movies initially, you know, when they were coming out because I was interested in Star Trek, and then eventually I think I started seeing all the movies simply because very often I was reviewing them or something like that.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Turkey where we knew about Star Trek, but, you know, Turkey in the 70s, I mean, before the age when TV shows and movies were released virtually simultaneously across the world, I mean, my favorite show growing up in the mid-70s was Space 1999, which is like the Star Trek knockoff, which we got in Turkey before we got Star Trek.
Wow. All right. That's a mirror universe if ever there was one.
So, but when I came back, when we moved to the U.S., I started watching Star Trek because it was simply on TV all the time after school. So.
And you said that when you were a kid, you had one of the old photo novels.
Yes. I had a photo novel of that, that classic episode, City on the Edge of...
Forever.
I keep wanting to say City on the Edge of Tomorrow for some reason. But
Well, there was a movie called Edge of Tomorrow, and there the time travel aspect.
But
in it,
yeah, so I had that book, but it was in English, so I couldn't actually read it, but I could look at the pictures and sort of... I think that was actually my very first exposure to Star Trek.
Wow. Also, was a photo novel in a language you didn't know.
Photo novel. And also, for some reason, I think because, you know, my parents had lived in the UK for a while, we actually had, or I actually had, a great Starship Enterprise, like, die-cast toy that, like, shot out little yellow pellets and stuff. And
awesome.
I probably should have kept in its box. And
yeah,
you know,
no, that
retire,
would be worth something now. Well, if you don't know what a photo novel is, they were made many moons ago. And it was basically screenshots of the show with a little bit of text. And it would be like, I don't know, 50 pages or so.
It was like a comic book with photographs.
Right, basically. Right. And I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, something of a financial boondoggle. They didn't do as well as they wanted them to do, so they stopped making them. But they're out there, and you can buy them. They're worth something on eBay. I mean, you could find them at conventions for like a buck or two, but a nice, pristine photo novel. Matt Patches... Unlike our other two guests, you are, let's face it, you speak for the nerds of the three assembled critics today.
Yeah, but I can't do the true Star Trek diehards.
But you are a nerd.
Justice.
You are a nerd.
Yeah.
You read comic books.
I do.
You read DC?
I actually read the Green Lantern Star Trek crossover comic book, so I feel like I have a little cred.
You read Green Lantern comics, you read Marvel comics, you like you are an enthusiast of movies like John Carter that nobody else liked.
That is true. Hey, wait! I bet you guys like John Carter.
I can't say I like it.
Okay.
I know I didn't hate it, and I've been wanting to see it again. I thought it was gorgeous.
I think it has like a big heart, also that I appreciate, even when I didn't think it
works. That's what gets me in movies.
It was hated too much.
You loved Tron Legacy.
Love, that's a strong word. I liked watching it.
I love Tron Legacy.
Oh, my God. This is,
yes. I like quoting Tron Legacy.
Fair enough. Matt Patches is the editor-in-chief of...
I'm the senior entertainment editor at Thrillist.com.
Thrillist.com, and prior to his work at Thrillist, you can read his work at Grantland and...
Defunct Grantland.
Defunct Grantland and Vulture and other websites out there.
Yeah.
So that's who everybody is. Great. So I want to open with this. Oh, and but your favorite, you said, Patches, your favorite Star Trek was Voyager.
I watched, like, week to week. I watched Voyager week to week because I grew up, my mom loved Next Generation. And so did my uncles were all into Star Trek, too. I probably knew the posters before I did, watched any actual Star Trek.
Yeah.
But then, watched a lot of, I have no memory for names or episodes, so I could not be a true nerd when it came to Star Trek, which was so much memorization, but I was able to watch Voyager week to week. So
nice.
I probably had a closer relationship to like Neelix and Tuvok than I would ever Kirk and Spock.
I'm doing the math on here. You were a young lad coming of age. I would think you had a close relationship with Seven of Nine.
Well, that's an after dark episode of this podcast, I think.
Not that you didn't respect her work in Astrometrics. I'm just saying she was a very comely
woman.
No,
it really woke Voyager up.
Yes, yes, yes.
In terms of the drama.
Season 4, things changed. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Star Trek Beyond. This is we're allowed to talk spoilers, so don't feel like you have to censor yourself. I'm going to go around the room, starting with bullet point A, which is the plot of this film. Which I think, even as someone who really liked it, I will admit...
Well, should you set it up? Like, give us a little background
here. The plot is this. The movie begins. The Enterprise has been out in space for 3 years, which is kind of an in-joke because the original series only lasted 3 years, so it's like, it's just our 3 years, so it's as if, what if one day after the three years of the show? And Kirk is kind of a little bored. He even makes a reference to, like, another daily episode.
Right, it's feeling episodic out here
feeling
in space.
Feeling episodic out in space. Simon Pegg, who co-wrote the script, is very clever. And the opening bit, which is sort of like a prologue, feels very Simon Pegg. It reminded me a lot of The World's End or Shaun of the Dead, sort of clever writing and fast cutting.
Actually, it reminds me a lot of The World's End. They go in The World's End, they're, like, looking up at giant space figures, right? And they're...
Yes.
Yeah, it's
and that's
exact
the
ending,
ending
of
World's End. It's the same ending as
The
World's End.
Of this.
With a little bit less beer. Although they are drinking at the end of Star Trek Beyond, so maybe it is like The World's End.
Yeah, they're drinking at the beginning, too. Some nice scotch, if I recall.
That's true.
Stolen scotch.
So, stolen scotch from Chekhov. So, he's feeling a little blasé, like maybe it's time to hang it up. They check in at the Yorktown, which is this amazing set. Really cool. I hope everybody else dug it as much as I did.
It's like Sid Mead's space station meets Druidia from Spaceballs. Because it has that air.
There is an air container. It looked to me like 15 Ramas from Rendezvous with Rama, how I pictured Rama in my head. It's like a giant city in like a Dyson sphere.
Luke is just shaking his head. What the hell are you talking about?
It was some nerd ass stuff. All right, well, I'm just deciding. So they get there, and then a ship is like, oh my God, there's a nebula, and our ship got trapped. We need help. And Kirk's like, fine, we'll do the rescue mission. What the hell? Why not? And it turns out that things go south really quickly. The ship gets attacked. It gets destroyed. They all wind up on this planet. They have to plan an escape, and then they got to save the Yorktown because the baddies are going to attack the Yorktown. It's a pretty... thin plot. And I don't know that that necessarily is a bad thing, because Star Trek Into Darkness had a very complex pretzel plot that ultimately was kind of negative and disappointing. And this is just, for me, so thin that you don't really care. It's like, yeah, it's a bad guy. He's going to kill people. We got to stop him. And then you can just sort of hang out with the characters as they solve these problems. There's a lot of, if you like these characters, you're going to get to spend time with them in what feels like an episodic way. The thing that I took out of this movie was, if we ever wanted to see this iteration of Kirk, Spock, Bones in an episode, that's this movie. It's like 2.5 episodes of the TV show that will never happen with these characters, with Justin Lin's action set pieces. Let's start with you. Do you agree with what I just said?
That is
vis-a-vis the plot.
Yes, I agree.
But no, the question is, do you... I said we're going around the room. Do you feel that this plot was asinine and too thin and ridiculous, or was it just enough to get you going?
I don't mind that it feels episodic. I think in general, Star Trek lives better in an episodic format, which is why the movies often feel just not as appealing to me than watching Next Generation. You know, I think that especially of these last three, I really enjoyed the first Star Trek. I didn't like the second one, and I would say this comes in somewhere in between for me. But its plot is thin, and I think does end up echoing themes from the last one. That said, I agree that I think that the characters hanging out and spending time together in different configurations is the strongest part of the movie.
I think the thinness works because it actually makes you care for these situations and these characters. I mean, the two things that jumped out early on, and at the time as I was watching it, they felt slightly out of place, but they were paid off fairly well later, was, you know, first we see Kirk walking through the halls of the Enterprise, and he's looking at the rest of the crew, and they're all in slow motion, and they're interacting, and there are people flirting, and there are people drinking and having fun and whatever. And, you know, he's doing his, you know, very Kirkian sort of existential crisis, talking about, you know, what's his? It can be a challenge to feel grounded when even the gravity is artificial. You know, like, I mean, this
Terrence
is
Malick, Star Trek.
Well, it's like, it feels very, I mean, this is a kind of very canned kind of Hollywood sentiment. But yeah. I think that Justin Lin is very good at selling that sort of thing. So those scenes on the Enterprise at first kind of jumped out as, because the first two movies were so fast. I mean, yeah, they are just like breakneck for better and for worse. This one kind of settled down, which I was surprised by, given that it's Justin Lin who did like the Fast and Furious movies. But and then when they arrive on at Yorktown, those sort of, and I agree, it was beautifully done, but those sort of indulgent, dizzying shots of Yorktown with like the booming orchestral music, I mean, all these symphonic crescendos, and you're kind of like, what is going on? Like, why is it spending so much time like twirling around the cityscape like we've never seen anything like this before, which we totally have, but it's nicely done.
Yeah.
But later on, I think that was paid off very nicely when the Enterprise is completely destroyed and like half the crew is sucked out into space, and I felt like sort of them doing that emotional, laying down that emotional groundwork actually helped pay that off later. And with Yorktown, eventually when it's, you know, inevitably threatened,
right,
all those initial shots of how beautiful and peaceful and wonderful it is, somehow that creates a certain level of urgency later on. So I thought that was all actually fairly, very slickly, very, yeah, kind of competently handled.
I think there is a really nice balance between the action sequences, which mostly work, not all of them do, but most of them work, which J.J. Abrams' films, they work too. But what Abrams didn't do, there really isn't a lot of the characters talking. Like, whenever you think you're going to settle in and sink your teeth into the characters, there's a cut and they zoom off. And Abrams does it well that you don't really notice until later. It's like, oh, it would have been nicer to linger on that. And this movie, again, counterintuitively, does that pretty well. Maybe that's the yin and yang of having Simon Pegg write the script, who's more known for his character development and sort of clever script writing, and Justin Lin, who's known more for explosions and fast cars.
But I thought,
maybe there's the Bones Spock dynamic there.
I am going to challenge your assertion that Justin Lin is known mostly for,
well, his first movie is an indie film. Yes.
No, I think that the Fast and the Furious movies are sold equally on giant explosions and on a corny but deeply sincere and resonant affirmation of family and connection.
Yeah,
and friendship.
50% of the Fast and Furious movies is standing around the garage being like, "Who wants a Corona? I love you, bro."
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually a structure very similar to,
yeah, there's
this
a lot of atmosphere.
Sorry, I mean,
yes.
Kirk, Spock, Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, and then they're like crew of kind of, you know, yeah, slightly wisecracky,
yeah,
you know, vaguely incompetent.
Everyone has a talent. And, yeah.
Well, you know, maybe this is finally going to be the moment that gets me to reassess the Fast and the Furious movies.
Probably not. Let's
be
honest.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like
you. I mean, I've seen most of them, and they're, you know, I like the fifth one particularly. It had that scene with the block of cement that I thought was cool.
It's not a block of cement. Isn't it
a safe?
A safe that they pull out of a jail.
Yeah.
Well, it's made out of cement.
No, it's probably made out of metal.
Yeah, it's a safe.
Oh. Well, I don't remember it that well. These movies
clearly
didn't
not.
Stick to my
mind.
It was
wrist. Moving too fast and furiously
it's
for
It's very
you.
Fast. What about
Wait,
the plot of
I need
the,
to be I need to be a yeah. voice of dissent here.
Yeah, oh. Oh, that's right. That's the irony about this is that of the three guests, you're the one who kind of liked it the least.
Well, I should say that I like most of the original cast's movies, and I like First Contact. And probably
no, I mean this.
No,
film.
No, no, I yeah. know, and I wept at Star Trek 2009. I love that movie, and I kind of like Into Darkness. I know that is a crazy opinion, but
no, it's
I watched it once. I had a good time. I wish they hadn't kept Khan secret, but whatever. This movie kind of was a disappointment for me. I enjoyed it sporadically, but for me, and I think you'll hear a lot of this, this is just like an original series episode is the most damning backhanded compliment.
Oh.
Because it's not a television episode. It is a movie. And for all its like little character moments that we really like, it's muddled by the fact that we haven't had, 20 more behind it, that we don't have more episodes to come where these relationships can be kind of strung out. Like the Spock-Uhura relationship is terrible. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's so fake.
And
it's diluted in this movie.
I suspect that there were some things cut out of the script to make it streamlined.
But I think at its worst, this movie gets too big for its britches. It's like trying to stuff set pieces into this kind of we're just going to be on a planet situation. And the nice thing about an episode of the original series, we don't need to set up why they're stumbling into a scenario, right?
Yeah.
They just end up at a planet, and they go down, and something happens, and then they fix it.
That's kind of what happens here.
It definitely happens in the middle act, but that means it's rushed, and that means that the setup is hokey. The whole, I made a joke about Terrence Malick's Star Trek. I would have liked, just from the perspective of Kirk, like, feeling the weight of the mission and being lost, and if the whole thing was just about him. This movie reminds me a lot of Mission Impossible 3, which does have its champions and has its naysayers like I think it's trying to scale back to what we love about the show and be more character driven and teamwork, but at the end of the day it's still a movie, so why is it going to be this big and why do the battles have to be
movie,
but like it can't balance this movie can't balance the small character stuff and the big set piece stuff because it wants to be an episode of television but it also needs to be a blockbuster movie, and to be honest it has less in common with Fast and the Furious than it does Justin Lin's True Detective episodes Justin Lin is a television director at heart. He's a guy who steps in and he gets the movie done for you. I think this emulates J.J. Abrams' movies quite a bit. But I would like to see more Justin Lin in this movie, him directing the Fast and Furious action scenes.
Well, but there are, by my count, four gigantic action scenes. There's the scene where the Enterprise is destroyed, which frankly is a little long. That went on a little long, I felt. Like, the Enterprise takes a long time to get destroyed.
It's a big ship.
It's a big ship. And some of that fight geography, I thought, got a little bit lost. Somehow Spock and Bones end up on one of the baddies' little ships. There's this murmuration of swarm ships, and they're in an escape pod, and suddenly they're in the ship. It's like, did I see that happen? It's like, oh, yeah, I guess I kind of did the moment when there's a swoop. But if you blink, you miss it. And there's a lot of running around dark corridors, and some of it's cool, but not all of it.
Yeah.
And then there's another big action sequence when Kirk and Chekhov go back to the damaged ship, and I feel like that was sort of go somewhere else, have your bag, because it was dark. They're back on the ship again, and the gag was leading to something that I don't think worked for me. This is, I thought, the worst part of the movie, where the saucer of the section of the ship flipped over.
They can reboot it.
Yeah, and it flips over, and they slide down the front. And I could see being in the writer's room being like, this is going to be amazing. We're going to flip the saucer over, and they're going to slide down the front. It's like it's never happened on Star Trek before, and that is cool, in theory. But I don't think it worked for me, that particular action beat. Then there's the action scene where they got to save the prisoners. I thought that was cool. And then they got to save the Yorktown at the end, where they use the Beastie Boys song.
Twice. They save the Yorktown twice.
Yes, they save it in space and they save it
on a smaller scale.
On their, they're flying around in the Matrix.
I guess they're just
which was shorter, which was fine. That was those, I like that because that was those, that didn't last too long.
Well,
the Matrix
and
fight.
Those you know those kind of climactic scenes, I felt played to Justin Lin's strengths because I mean he's all about vehicles and bodies and motion and space. And I mean the whole thing when they're on the planet and you know Kirk's riding around on the motorcycle and you know Jayla has to jump and then he has to jump and then they I mean that's basically one of the key quote unquote stunts from Furious 6 you know, replayed with teleporters right. And then the whole thing in Yorktown with like you know one ship has to like lead the other ship and then has to like distract the other ship and then the other big ship is coming, it's all like that basically felt like you know a Fast and Furious.
Although I think the problem is with Fast and the Furious, because they're using real elements and they're shooting on the streets and then they're supplementing with CGI, they're forced to pick angles, specific angles that the actual cameras can fit into, or wide shots to a lot. Like, we got to get all the. We're putting real cars in here. Let's do it. And here, you almost want Justin Lin to be more restrained. I think the best action sequence of the movie is the bike scene where he's driving around what seems to be like a real set that they've built in this rocky area. But everything else seems mangled by the fact that it's all CG or little bits of set that have to be supplemented with zooming back and forth around the Enterprise and that sort of thing.
Well, I think he also he tries to really be set free in terms of his sense of space and in terms of gravity. You know, I think there are a lot of those sequences that are in space that he tries not to think on a kind of like plane, but to have things going all over the place. And that's true of the kind of climactic sequence where they go into Yorktown or whatever. You know, they're going, like, in different colliding directions.
It's like an M.C. Escher
action scene. I think he's more ambitious than he can necessarily pull off with that in terms of coherence.
And I don't quite understand why, like, there's a moment where it's like, the gravity's going to be weird up there. Like, all right, sure. And then they're flying around, which is cool. If you want to see Chris Pine as a superhero, this is your opportunity.
I look forward to reading the, like, Trek core explanation or the Memory Alpha page on whatever the heck was happening in Yorktown at the end, because Simon Pegg is just rattling off these explanations, explanations of what they're going to do, like... You know, the whole swarm action scene at the end outside of Yorktown is predicated on, well, we're going to scramble the telepathic
orders. They're going to rock them to death with the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, which is great. I needed the Uhura to step out and be like, we're just going to fuck them. Can I say that?
You can now.
But then Simon Pegg is just like a whirlwind of explanation. That's what happens at the end of the movie. It's all kind of crescendoing, culminating, and he's just spitting these orders out. And I'm like, why is Kirk flying? It doesn't matter. Whatever.
There is, I think, and that is a moment that will be a bridge too far for some Star Trek fans. The very same bridge that killed Captain Kirk in Generations. That bridge is back again because Trek-no-babble has always had its roots in a little bit of sense, and the Trek-no-babble here is beyond, Star Trek beyond silly. I mean, it makes sense, and they sell it. The actors sell it. Simon Pegg sells it. Jayla, and I want to talk about Jayla in a minute. But the big, they save the day by using rock rap music. What does Jayla call it? Shouting and beats? Beats and shouting?
I like the beats and the shouting.
Yeah, the beats
that
and the
part
shouting.
Is awesome.
Oh, and but it's, in,
but
it's great.
But it's in, I mean, the Beastie Boys are basically like, you know, they're canon in the new Star Trek,
the Beastie
right?
Boys have been
that
in
the That is
all
the weirdest emergence in the series.
They're classical music.
Because Kirk does smile and acknowledge, like, oh, I know this song. I listened to it
when I was 10.
Yeah. Well, not only that, in Star Trek: The Darkness, he had a threesome with two Catons to check it out, I think. One of the Beastie Boys songs. So Beastie Boys is in all three of the Kelvin films. You know, they explain, like, we're going to reroute the blah, blah, blahs to use radio waves and we'll disorient them and all right. But I'll tell you, Justin Lin and all the actors make it work and it's very funny, but some people will not be able to handle it. I want to warn you now, trigger warning to some, you're going to have a heart attack if you can't handle it. Personally, yes, it's not the Star Trek that I knew and Captain Picard would never do that, but I still kind of dug it.
It was definitely a rock music video moment when Yorktown starts blasting the music.
Yes.
And I don't know how they triggered this image in my mind. I think we all collectively had this. It looked like speakers blowing out flames into the swarm. And it was insane.
You know,
everyone threw up devil horns.
I wonder to what extent that was inspired by Mad Max Fury Road. It might have been.
You think this was a Doof Warrior moment?
No, I feel like that, like they just went for it. And it's like, people like Mad Max Fury Road. Hell, they got nominated for the Oscar. Let's just go bananas.
Did not think that.
I don't know. So what? Let's talk about the two new characters. Jayla, who we never find out what her alien species name is. She's just a marooned alien.
We'll have to wait for the novelization.
I was wondering if is she from the same quote unquote species that Krall and the others are? Because it seemed almost like
I think her explanation was that Krall has been attacking ships that cross this planet, and that she is the survivor of a fallen.
Yeah.
And that there are others.
Let's talk about Krall and his alleged motivations in a moment, which is definitely the weak link in this motion picture. But Jayla, played by a woman whose name I can't remember right now.
Sophia Boutella?
Thank you.
Yes, she's in Kingsman.
She played the woman with the sword legs in Kingsman. She was great in that. She is she's an athlete, an acrobat, and now
and
an
she's
actress.
She's a dancer.
She's a dancer, yeah.
Well, athlete, acrobat, dancer. That's okay. That's what that is.
I was surprised to discover it was her.
Oh.
I thought she was fine here, but I thought Kingsman actually used her abilities a little better.
Her acrobatic.
Well, she only gets
abilities.
Really one big fight scene, and again, it's shot almost entirely in close up, and it felt so suffocating, that action scene when she's beating some goon up, that when it pulled back to wide and she got like five sustained seconds of like kick-ass moment,
yeah.
Everyone clapped.
It did.
It's like we finally get to see her in all her glory.
Well, maybe that's
Jayla rules.
That could be the brilliance of the filmmaking technique. They use the compression and release there to
make
get
me feel bad. Make me not enjoy this. Oh yeah, it's enjoyable.
You
now.
Never know. You never know. She's really fun, and she has sort of mangled English, so that's cute. She calls. She doesn't understand how names work, so she calls Scotty Montgomery Scotty. Which reminded me of Jake Sully from Avatar.
I kept thinking of Avatar, too. But not in a good way.
Oh!
Sorry.
No. And then she kept calling Captain Kirk James T. Like James T, which I thought was adorable. I don't know if that was the intent, but that immediately ingratiated me to her. What did you think of Jayla?
I think she's fine. I don't, like, I to have her kind of thrown out there to be like, I don't know, here's your new favorite character. I didn't really do it for me.
Aww.
I think I think her fight choreography is underwhelming. I don't think that has anything to do with the actress. I think that just for someone who is supposed to be such a badass, I don't think she actually gets showcased that well in that.
Not only that, she kind of shoves Uhura off the stage also.
Yeah.
It's like
this movie has
only
room
space
for one woman.
One.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
You know, I think that she looks very cool.
She does.
She's like
she's got a ponytail.
Yeah,
she's adorable.
Like, she has some cool weapons.
White, yeah.
Everybody
and
has
like
ponytails.
Black.
What do you mean, everybody?
Isn't ponytails like? I mean,
I know who has like loose flowing hair. Very few people.
Well, it's not good for battle. If
yeah.
She's working on the ship.
It's all business.
She
there
is.
Are probably regulations as to how you have to wear your hair anyway.
Jayla's not part of the Federation.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
lives on her own. She lives
no, she's
by the end.
She's a practical girl.
She yeah.
Yeah. I thought the speech thing was very funny. I don't think there was enough there to really hang on to make her more than just like a character of the week.
It kind of goes back to my complaint about the whole like the big picture, which is I would love the whole movie to just take place on this planet. If they could get to the planet immediately and the whole thing was, okay, we're going to crash and everyone's going to be in different places and then Scotty and Jayla will be on a part and Kirk and Chekhov will have their beat and Spock and Bones. There's just not enough breathing room to this whole multi-pronged story where they're all going to meet up eventually because there has to be an opening set piece have to get to the space battle and then we need the finale space battle and you want the whole thing. I mean, I guess this was the downfall of Insurrection.
Right, which was just an episode as a movie.
It really was, but if you could do it with the pizzazz of Beyond,
you might have
want a whole planet
episode. I understand what you're saying. I still think the movie is quite good, but I would be curious to see what amount of screen time is once everybody's landed to they've all escaped. It's probably not that long.
I think everyone gets two scenes.
It's not that big. Like, it's ostensibly a jailbreak of the people who didn't get captured, and that is kind of quick. But, you know,
it's the second act.
It's the second act.
Well, I was surprised how quick we get to the jailbreak. I thought that was going to be the
big culminating. They kind of like, we're going to do it this way, and then they do it.
Because I know that Kirk has to fight Krall, like hand-to-hand combat. It has to be. It's
right.
Definitely going to be that way. But I thought it was going to happen on the planet where most of the action's taking place. So that, like, I loved Spock and Bones in this movie.
Yeah,
I wanted
that was
more
really
Spock and Bones. I wanted more Kirk and Chekhov, who was non-existent in Into Darkness. And of course, we love Anton.
I suspect that there was a lot more of Chekhov in the original script.
Jordan's winking at me.
I'm not winking at you. I suspect that there was more Chekhov in the original script, and for whatever reason, it got cut. God knows why. But
timing. I mean, the movie's a solid 2 hours. It can't really go much longer.
But, you know, you say I want more. The scenes with Bones and Spock were awesome, and it would have been great to have more of that, but we had none of that in the last one. So don't be so greedy.
Well, sure. Okay. I guess I feel like bringing this back to Jayla, it felt like it was hard to invest in the arc of this character when I wanted just to spend more time with the main characters.
Oh, okay.
You know,
this new girl?
I don't like it. Tries to give her this whole arc about abandonment and she lost her parents.
Well, that was to
and
tie
also
her
she's
into...
vaguely reminiscent of Rey from.
A little bit of Star Wars.
Rey. Yeah.
Like, I hadn't thought of that till
like
now.
Living on the planet by herself. In this abandoned ship
from a war.
They even have a similar look in terms of like their outfits and their. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. But she's cooler. J.J. Abrams' note? Is this,
no, she's cooler than Rey. She's cooler
than Rey.
Hey,
we figured out people love this.
That's a good point that I hadn't thought of. But also, there's some parallels between her relationship with her parents and Kirk's relationship with his fallen father, which is very trace elements.
I don't see the movie making that connection.
They cut to each other. She's talking about her dead father, and just in the beginning of the movie, he's thinking about his dead father. They cut to his face.
I feel like his angst about his dead father was very different, though. I mean, I feel like his, I don't know, that connection I think would have worked in one of the earlier movies, but at this point, he's dealing with some other struggle.
I think that it was kind of a, let's throw that in the stew also. Let's talk about we're nitpicking a little bit. Let's talk about
what? We're not nitpicking.
Let's talk a little bit about
Shields up, Jordan. Jeez.
Oh wait, hold on. Let me hold on. Where's Shields up on this? I have that. 39. Okay.
Ray Shields.
There we go. Let's talk about Krall. Is Krall a good character? Give me a yes or no.
Not really.
No. Okay.
Not really. I mean, he's menacing enough, but I wasn't particularly. It became fairly clear relatively early on that it was Idris Elba playing him, so I became invested in him just because I like Idris Elba.
Right.
But,
right.
He's not a particularly. I mean, he looks like any number of Star Trek villains I feel like I've seen. But the other thing about him was, you know, they try to give him this sort of backstory that feels vaguely like something that we might have seen in Into Darkness.
Also, the episode Pattern of Force, the original series episode, it's kind of taken from that.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing about it that I felt like his backstory was kind of... doing the work that in the original series, perhaps the sort of more topical, allegorical, more cerebral aspects of, you know, Gene Roddenberry's vision might have done. I mean, it felt like, you know, these movies don't really have that element. They don't have that sort of weird allegorical thing that the original series, I feel like, had.
I think that's a fair statement.
And I feel like him as a character and his backstory was somehow meant to sort of resonate beyond.
Right. And it didn't. Because it happens 5 minutes before the end of the movie. Now, did anybody guess who he was? There's an alleged twist.
You
got it.
From like the moment that you see the video of the old crew, I knew exactly what was going to happen.
I didn't pick up on it. I picked up on it when he grabs like the necks of two crew members, red shirts, and then sucks their life out somehow. How does he do that?
There's a lot that's unstated.
Is that the mine? He's mining for something that allows. I don't know. But as soon as he can, as soon as he can suck their life force out, I'm like,
I know what's going on. Okay, yeah. I'm going to say this. I am a brilliant man, but when it comes to guessing the endings of movies, I'm like a pack lead, which is a Star Trek term for dumb cough.
An
idiot, a schmuck, a schmendrick. I never guess the endings of movies. I am surprised at whatever it is. When the lights go out, the suspension of disbelief takes over. I guessed the ending of this film, which was like the first time ever. That tells you how bad the character of Krall is. So I knew the twist. I don't understand what he was trying to do. He wanted that Googaw to kill, and he wanted to kill the Federation because he was angry. And I think, you tell me if I'm correct, he was a Federation starship captain, originally a warrior, and then the Federation became peaceful. He was on a mission. He got sucked behind a nebula. He couldn't get saved, so he got pissed off at the Federation for not saving him.
Yeah.
And also then started disagreeing with the basic idea of the Federation.
Yeah, he's not one for unity.
Yes.
Yeah,
but that, does anybody feel that that was done well?
I mean, no, but I do think that there are a lot of, there's potential in that, that
yes.
I wish
oh,
that, there, you know, I
yeah.
think that the character has a lot of potential to be better. I think that you can't just then skip to the end over, oh, and then I used this alien technology to become this monstrous version of myself. And now I'm going to try and destroy your, you know, settlement.
Yeah, it's a little half-assed.
I think that if you're going to have that and have this character be tragic, it, which it definitely tries to do at the end,
yeah.
then you need to actually show what happens, and you need to kind of delve into that a bit
right.
more.
Like, as Wrath of Khan is like, he's trapped, he's abandoned, he hates Kirk, and he, you know, he says his wife has died, and they're struggling on the sand and all that. There's none of that in this.
It's
right.
the same motivation with none of the... Not, it's not showing the work at all.
It's that's a good way of putting it. It's not showing the work. Now, for hardcore Star Trek fans, though, it will be interesting because the Kelvin timeline and the Prime timeline share a point of unity, which is the series known as Star Trek Enterprise, which no one in this room other than me has watched. And Idris Elba's character, he's not from the show Star Trek Enterprise, but he makes a lot of references to Enterprise. And there's a scene where Spock's wearing a leftover jacket, and that's from that show. So that's pretty cool from like a Star Trek fans who are going to be annoyed at the use of the Beastie Boys are going to be excited about that. So that's the yin and yang at that, at least. So
what was the good. War that he fought in?
Oh, the Zindi War. Yes, that's from canon. That's a great.
I wanted to make sure that we
I nearly
got
lost my shit. I didn't. I wish I was sitting next to Scott Calera from IGN, who probably the only other person in that room who knew about the Zindi War. He's like, I fought the Zindis for you. I'm like, oh, he did fight the Zindis. Oh my god, it was amazing. So.
Wow.
Yes, the Zindi.
That was not enough to make him an interesting character.
No. But it, you know, it means that Simon Pegg is a cool guy.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
Is this movie nerdy? Star Trek is nerdy shit. It's supposed to be. And the other movies have had wormholes. They've had red matter. Star Trek episodes can sometimes have interdimensional phase space. Other than the fact that little Keenzer, the green guy, has acidic snot that can melt doors, which is awesome. Is there anything nerdy in this
Can I
film?
Just speak to Keenzer's snot for a second?
Talk about Keenzer's snot.
I'm a little annoyed at this addition because this revelation. It's all so that they can get out of jail.
Yeah.
It's just like...
They can do it by...
Put these pieces in place so they can obviously solve our
plot problems.
They
gotta
get out
of jail somehow. In the past, you know, Spock's used a lot of mind melding to get out of jail.
Sulu's a smart guy. He can figure out how to get out of jail.
They use Keenzer's snot.
Yeah, but like, Uhura's there. Why can't she have a skill that allows them to get out? Like,
you know
why
what her
do
skill is?
Character moments should solve these problems.
Her skill is knowing that their young Roiland engineer has acidic snot. And if he can hock a serious loogie on the door, they're going
to
get out.
But actually, we don't see them solve that problem. It's a smash cut to Keenzer sneezing on
the
door lock.
That's because we trust them.
I'm glad Keenzer had a bigger part, though, in this movie.
Keenzer's so much Keenzer. And they say him by name. Kirk even says, hey, Keenzer.
He does, because Keenzer now has a friend who's like somehow
below.
Keenzer has a Keenzer.
It's great. But is
nerdiness.
Other than Keenzer's snot, is Star Trek Beyond a nerdy film, or is it just an action film?
I don't think it's that nerdy. It bothered me that the big weapon was such just the badass weapon that makes no sense and is never explained.
It makes CGI, like vinaigrette come out and attack you. I don't know what it was that was attacking
Like the
people.
Explanation behind it, the idea that some civilization just bat it out into space in parts to get rid of it. Like, you know, it was such just a MacGuffin.
It's serious MacGuffin. And, you know, it was funny because the movie opens with this, as Spock calls it, a doodad. No, excuse me, Bones calls it a doodad. And actually Spock calls it a doodad, too, as a joke. It would be like as if Raiders of the Lost Ark was not about the Ark, but about that gold head from the beginning of the movie. Like that little trinket, and then the whole movie's about that trinket. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't like that the cold open. The cold open is very funny.
Yeah.
Especially the reveal that those big aliens are little aliens. Yeah. That's funny. But that brings us into the plot as a whole, like that object.
It annoyed me too.
It just doesn't make any sense. It's so disappointing on multiple levels because, yeah, it has no basis in Star Trek history. It has no basis in new canon writing. You know, they're not creating something interesting or subverting the past. And then, of course, yeah, as you said, as it explodes out into space, it's just those micro robot things from the G.I. Joe movies, or it's just the changing parts of the Transformers movies, or it's just, you know, it's we've seen it so many times. I don't know what the fascination is with these big blockbusters to have a million moving parts. Is that what spectacle when you're working in the CG labs is at this point?
Like, you also,
that's a tremendous diss, but
you told me that you were really disappointed with the swarm ships.
Yeah, just on like a visual level. Like, I get no thrill out of seeing a million moving parts.
Did you feel the
smash?
I love the swarm ships too.
I loved watching them smash into the Enterprise. When I say that, I was crying because the Enterprise was being attacked, but you see them from the point of view of space and they look tiny, but then you go into a corridor and they're like the size of a Buick smashing into the walls.
And they've got people in them and they look like flying claws, but I mean, I love the way it played with scale, so you couldn't quite ever tell how big they were until they smashed it, and then like actual.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I just didn't find it that menacing because it was so chaotic at all. You know, they make a big point of they're being controlled because they're a million moving parts. They have to be controlled telepathically so that they can kind of flow like birds or something, but they never have that elegance. I wish there was this kind of controlled chaos to them where it really seemed like Krall was manning this swarm.
I don't even know that Krall was in charge of the swarm. I don't know who was in control of the swarm. That's why the Beastie Boys were able to destroy them. It was a little weird. But I will say that I disagree. I think they looked really cool, and I love when they were on the planet.
They were genuinely menacing. I mean, they terrified me.
They look,
especially
they look like
when like none of the normal defensive and offensive measures work.
Yeah.
That scene is really frightening.
That was cool,
frightening.
Where they're shooting the proton.
You know what I think they might have been based on? The old video game Galaga, which were like insect ships that all move in like a curl together. I think that there's some Galaga in this, not Galaxian, Galaga.
Well, there's kind of like a nanobot, right?
Yeah.
Like air to them. I think both in the weapon and what it does and in, like, they echo each other.
That's why the weapon didn't bother me either, because it felt of a piece with the swarm. It felt like that felt like kind of the scientific aesthetic of the movie.
You're absolutely right. I didn't like the story element, but I'm like, yeah, the swarming vinaigrette wasn't so bad. But what I love in the planet was when the swarm ships docked. They looked like they were in cell phone towers, you know, because they were all like, it was like a big pole and they boop, 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 right along each side. So I thought that was pretty cool.
But like, why is that stuff there? Why?
Because they attack
people in
a cool
way. What
does this
weapon do? We get to see it used once, and I'm still not sure. He locked two parts together, and now he can dissolve people?
Because he's bad.
Couldn't he just shoot that lady? I don't know. I don't get it.
You're not wrong. His motivation is the bad guy.
Well, it's a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah,
that's the idea behind it.
But it doesn't quite cut. Like you said, it doesn't really show the work. But the other, I can't stress enough. I really dug the Yorktown. I like the use of water in the Yorktown. Like there were these underground tunnels where like the pipings are and whatnot, and then you go up a little bit and then you're in a stream and then you come out, and it was cool sci-fi, I thought. Cool sci-fi look. I wanted to talk about one other thing, which was eventually this is going to dissipate as a news item, but coming into this movie, Sulu is gay. It is a kind of a big news story. This made international news. And we saw how it worked in the film. You and I, Allison Patches and I, had a conversation before we saw the film where you both were annoyed, but then you said, but I haven't seen the movie yet, so let me wait till I see the movie. Annoyed not because you're homophobes. Annoyed because you
please stress
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you. No, you were annoyed for other sort of left wing reasons. So, how do you feel afterwards? And how did you think about the way it was in the film? Just if people haven't watched it yet, you know, you see Sulu's daughter and his partner twice, and then at the end when the Yorktown's being destroyed, there's a close up of him again, and it's not a blink and you miss it thing. They get a beat. There's no dialogue. But they get a beat and a reverse
Kirk's
shot.
Yeah, talking about family and talking about coming back to people that you love. And then, there's Sulu
and his family. And
his
cut
husband.
Back to Kirk, and Kirk is like, hey, there's my good friend Sulu and his loving
family. And we don't
family.
Lose track of Sulu's husband during the movie, because when Yorktown's being attacked, you get to see him in a pack of people looking scared. And then at the end party, when they're all just hanging out.
Yeah,
like,
he's there
like
again.
They're the Avengers or something. He's there too.
Yeah, and they're all wearing cool street clothes. That's kind of new to Star Trek. The clothing they're wearing at that little party at the end was the least Star Trek clothes I've ever seen a Star Trek character wear. And they all look great. Jayla looked great. She looked sexy in what she was wearing.
She had a white suit.
But it was like kind of like thin material that was kind of long and sort of like a sexy cardigan, you know? It was really nice.
She was wearing the uniform, basically the uniforms from the original series movies. Right? Don't they have like
same
a white?
Same colors. Yeah.
Cream.
Okay, well, let me reel it back in. I got a little bit excited. I was thinking about Jayla's outfit. So Gay Sulu. So beforehand, you were annoyed. Allison, you said something very funny about what you wanted to see, because you felt that this was ticking a box.
Yeah, I think that I appreciate that this is a milestone in terms of representation in the Star Trek universe, and that I'm sure that seeing that will be meaningful to people. But it isn't. It is incidental to the plot. It is just these scenes where, the husband doesn't get to talk. We see the family really quickly. It's a scene that I think could easily be snipped out or have some ADR of like, hi, cousin, or something when this is exported to any country in which they don't want, mainstream representation.
We're
going to
see about
LGBT.
That. We're going to know more about that in a few weeks.
I do think that if you're going to have a character be gay, that I would love to see it just actually incorporated, have like a romance or a relationship actually incorporated into the main part of the film, as opposed to being like, oh, and P.S., like, you know.
Well, what's interesting about the scene, I thought it was well done. It's elegant. You know, they don't hit it over the head.
Yeah.
It's integrated smoothly. But when they're coming into Yorktown, you'd think that people would be, I guess Kirk is kind of waxing poetic, right? That's voiceover, and he's feeling existential. So you don't get to hear the crew get excited to come home for... Like, I don't know anything about Yorktown. We get a little set up that it's this base in the middle of space, far away from everything, so as not to offend other planets. Why is anyone that we know there? Like, why is Sulu's husband living in Yorktown?
He's not living there. He's there to visit... Because he knows that that the Enterprise is going to dock for repairs, and he hasn't seen him in 3 years.
What would have been beautiful is any amount of excitement from people on the ship getting to come home. So there's no, I get to see my husband, and it's been three years.
No one else has any sense of like their life outside.
No, Spock and Uhura are on the ship. Everyone else, no one's coming to see anyone at Yorktown except Sulu. What? So you'd think like Sulu gets a moment on the ship, like, I'm stoked. Let's dock.
Yeah. Also, Sulu. I mean, like, that's actually very hard on a family.
But the other characters don't have families, right? I mean, Bones is divorced. We know that, right?
Let me tell you this: in canon, families off the ship is a pretty rare thing. In Voyager, she had a boyfriend, but everybody else was pretty much single. You know,
Chekhov spends the whole movie trying to get laid.
Picard didn't date much.
In the Kelvin universe. Yeah.
Bones is divorced. That's all you know.
You know, Kirk likes to have threesomes.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, Spock is with Uhura or not or whatever.
Yeah.
And Chekhov is trying to get laid. I mean, so it's not exactly like there were that many other avenues. I thought it was fine. I didn't, you know, it didn't bother me. It didn't bother me when they announced it, and it didn't bother me in the film. In terms of, I mean, how many times? I'm not even thinking specifically about other Star Trek movies, but how many times in Hollywood blockbusters have we seen the kind of obligatory shot of the wife and the kids? Sometimes they have a line, sometimes they don't.
But I hate that too.
I hate
it's always
too.
Annoying.
Okay. No, but at least it's on an equal footing.
But that's
footing
the whole
now.
Thing with, you know, representation is you know,
if you're going to do something dumb,
should get
do it
to do
for
the
us
things
does.
That, yeah. that people hate. I don't know that it's. I mean, somebody has to tick the box first, right?
I definitely don't Might agree well, with George Takei. I think he is incorrect about.
You disagree with George Takei?
Yeah, because he or Takei, he's slamming the fact that Roddenberry didn't make him gay in the first place, and we shouldn't.
Yeah,
like, that doesn't make any
bit.
Sense.
His explanation is silly.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Yeah.
But what you said, somebody has to tick the box first. You know, something that everybody knows about Star Trek that doesn't watch show is that it had the first interracial kiss. That's true. It wasn't a real kiss. It was a. They were forced
more
to kiss
smooch.
By
it.
It was more of a smooch. It was a season three episode where Uhura and Kirk were forced to kiss against their will. So it wasn't like they were in love.
But it still made the racists very upset.
It
right?
still it was the lowest rated episode of Star Trek because the South wouldn't run it. So, you know, yes, it ticks a box. So I'm going to say...
I want to add one more thing. It ticks a box, but I think maybe this is... I mean, there has been talk of the Star Wars movies eventually featuring a gay couple.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if this is kind of like they have to tick this box... In advance,
in so the franchise arms race,
Star Wars
to
can
beat
actually,
Star Wars.
Well, I mean, it's all J.J. Abrams, right?
So I hadn't thought about it like that, but I like the fact that Star Trek got there first. That's pretty cool. And you know, Star Trek has danced around gay representation before. There was the Trills are. All right, there was a lesbian kiss, but Trills are they live multiple lives and they're in a host body. So previous lovers that were male female were now two women and they kiss when they saw each other again.
Orlando or something,
yeah, something like that. So
isn't that more of a trans story?
Well, then there was another episode where there was a race that had no gender, and then there was one who was deviant that chose to have a gender, and she got the hots for Riker. And then there's a mirror universe where Kira, one of my favorite characters, in the mirror universe where evil Kira is pansexual and making out with everybody. So, which isn't necessarily putting that in a good light. I'm just saying that there has been some representation, but it's never been like this. And it's never been original series. Boom, iconic character. Sulu, he's gay. And what I like about it, in a way, is like the way it's discovered now, so matter-of-factly, that like, oh, this guy you know, it's like being in an office. You work in an office for 2 years. Oh, that guy, Bill, do you know, Bill and his husband's there. And you go, Bill's gay? I didn't know that. Oh, Bill's gay. All right, great. That's the way the world should be. And that's the way it will be in the future.
I just want to say, I like that Sulu is gay.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it took that step. But it just points out to me the biggest problem with this whole franchise, one that I really like, it should just be a television show. You know, if we had time to get to know these characters, there'd be breathing room to introduce Sulu's husband or bring him back or get to know Sulu and feel the excitement of going home. There's just not enough time to really feel this journey. And gosh, I just kept thinking throughout the movie, I love this cast so much and I want to see them interact. I can't wait for 18 more episodes. And I don't know if we'll ever get another movie out of this cast. That's the saddest thing.
This is probably the last time I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that this is the last time you'll see this cast. But
really?
I do. I mean, for...
But now Jayla's in Federation.
I mean, that's mostly real politic talking in terms of contracts and whatnot. I mean, who knows? If the movie makes $1 zillion, they'll bring them back. Trust me. But we will be seeing Star Trek on TV again soon, in just a few months, with the new show, which by the time this airs, by the time most people hear this, we're going to know the name of the new show, I think. Whoa. All right, we got to wrap it up because we've been here for about an hour. I'm going to ask you to, and I will say again, I want to say to the hardcore fans, there are some Easter eggs in this movie you're going to dig. The line about the green hand was pretty cool. You might have heard me yelp in the theater. If you were to give this movie a grade out of 10, starting with Bilga, I know the Village Voice doesn't make you do grades. I write for The Guardian. They make me give stars.
The Village Voice doesn't make me do grades, nor did Vulture or New York Magazine.
I know,
where
you're
I was
so
before.
Lucky. I toil because at The Guardian, where I do the bulk of my film criticism, they don't allow 0 stars. So once, and if anybody from The Guardian is listening, I love you to pieces. Please don't fire me. But the one thing I dislike is that it's 1 star, 2 star, 3 star, 4 star, 5 star. And there's no halves. So 1 is absolute death and destruction because there's no 0. And 5, you only want to give it out once in a while. So what that really means is there's only 2, 3, and 4. Because 1 and 5, you can only use a few of them a year. Otherwise, you become a critic known for hyperbole. Wink, wink.
Why are you winking at me? I'm not a critic known for hyperbole.
No, I know, I know. So 2, 3, and 4. So anyway, nevertheless, you're going to have to give it out of 10. 1 out of 10.
But I want to preface this by saying part of the thing about sort of number grading movies is you number grade all of them so that there is something to compare it to. So for me to say,
okay,
you know, I mean,
what you're saying is you don't want to do it.
Well, it's like a 6 or a 7 for me. It's a 6 or a 7.
Okay,
probably a 7 depends. I mean, I actually do wind up watching these Star Trek movies more than once, and that's usually when I get a better sense of what I think of it. I enjoyed it. It's probably about a 7.
Okay,
but you know, there are certain parts that are kind of dumb and perhaps even tiresome, but some of it I appreciate. Even some of the bad stuff, I like. So you know, there were a lot of cheap-looking sets and you know some bad effects, and I thought, well, that feels actually kind of like an homage to the original series, you know. So 7. Let's say
all right.
7.
Bill Gayavire says 7 only on this podcast. You'll never read his number grade in the Village.
Well, are you
Voice.
Suggesting that people read reviews instead of looking at Rotten Tomatoes numbers?
I would never suggest something so
this is your opportunity.
As to suggest that people
this is your opportunity
read
to make a
my reviews or any of our reviews.
Allison, give me a number grade.
Oh,
yeah, well, BuzzFeed does not make you do number grades either.
I would say I also fall between a 6 or 7. Let's go with a 6.5.
All right, wow. I like it. Patches, you have written in the past for outlets that make you give number grades.
I no longer have to do that. But Rotten Tomatoes makes you do that. That's the most disappointing.
They make you
thing.
Do the. They make you do fresh or rotten. You don't have to give a number.
Really?
You don't have to.
No, I should
that's
stop doing it. I should stop doing a number.
Wait, have you been doing a number this
I've
whole time?
I've just been doing a number, and there's a lot of decimal points because I don't like. I don't know.
You know, you used to write. You used to do reviews for IGN, and they would make you give like something point. Like you can give like something a 7.1.
Yeah. Yes, that's probably where I picked.
So it's out of 100.
Scrutiny.
So yeah. You're not. So I'm really stuck between 2 stars, 3 stars, and 4 stars, and you could pick a number ostensibly out of 100.
Right, yeah. I used to be, and now I have that bad habit. No, I do it. I do it on Rotten Tomatoes.
All right,
still.
So what
but I'm probably 6 out of 10 on this one. I feel like I sounded way harsh on this episode about Star Trek Beyond, but I really do.
You're gonna
like these characters,
and you're going to regret that because later in the year, when you're looking back at your favorite movies, you're going to say, "You know, I should have given it a 9 out of 10."
Well, absolutely not. But I mean, the best scene in this movie for me is when they re-engage the Franklin. The USS Franklin.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about that. That was buried.
The Enterprise
era. And they work
era.
Together, and they get to have, at its best, Star Trek is a submarine movie. Like, the crew's working together, and that's my favorite scene, when they're just like, you at the controls, you do this, what's like, read this meter. And that's that, and I wish the whole movie had been that.
Oh, fair enough. Well, I'm going to say that my letter grade, I did voice some complaints. I do feel that Krall is not coming together. I still think that... I don't quite understand his methods of being a baddie, and I don't really understand his motivations of being a baddie.
But you'll read his prequel comic book, probably.
I will. Oh, will I?
Oh, find out why he calls himself Krall.
Yeah, he just changed his name from like...
And kind of his race. Like, he's not,
He goes from Afro-British to Lizard.
Yeah.
How does he
David
get other
Ike is
people?
Right.
Are his cronies other people who fall
no
on
idea.
The planet?
I don't think so, because he says, I've only got 3 crew members
right,
left.
Right, I thought they were his 2 henchmen.
One of them is Shea Whigham from...
there's like a lot of people.
Yeah, Shea Whigham, I thought Shea Whigham was...
Crabhead?
Was at the beginning, was one of the guys in the beginning.
Oh, no? Gosh.
There's also, no we didn't talk about Crabhead. We talked about the 2 new characters, Jayla and...
oh, Crabhead who hides the MacGuffin
hides
in her
she's
head.
She's a crab alien that we've never seen before and hides the
look more like a face crawler.
Yeah, that's like something out of Alien.
But in reverse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so, right.
so
no,
it's benign.
As a head.
So it's benign.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. Okay, so my number grade out of 10, I'm going to give it a 706 out of 10. That's my review.
Wow.
This is why I didn't review
Hyperbole.
The movie, because I get a little crazy when it comes to Star Trek. I can't be
Fair
trusted
enough.
For a mainstream audience. I can't write about this for The Guardian as a review, because I'm just too close to it. I'm like an alcoholic for Star Trek. So I want to thank everybody for coming. Matt Patches of Thrillist.com. You can be found on Twitter at Mr. Patches, right?
Yes, M-I-S-T-E-R Patches.
Right. And Allison Wilmore of BuzzFeed. On Twitter, you're just your name, right?
Allison Wilmore. 1 L in Allison, 2 L's in Wilmore.
I want to ask you about that. Some women some women spell Allison with 2 L's. It's like, and sure. And some do it with 1.
Yeah.
Like Hillary.
Some even throw in a Y.
Oh, that's too much.
Two Y's.
Yeah. As many Y's as
then it's a Star Trek name.
Yeah. Do you, so you're 1L.
Yes.
Now, do you have any sort of envy toward 2L'd Allisons? Or do you feel superior to them? Like, why are you wasting your time with that extra L?
On Twitter, it gives you an extra character.
It does. Yeah. I'm in peace with the 1L.
Do you get annoyed if somebody sends you an email and they put 2 L's in your Allison?
Well, then it doesn't get to me, so.
Well, not in.
So, no, she does not get annoyed by that.
All right. All right, so you're on Twitter at Allison Warren. And Bilge Ibirra, how does one find you on Twitter? It's your name.
It's my name. BILGEEBIRI.
Okay, and no underscore or anything like that.
No underscore. Okay, spelled bilge.
Like, so, you know, it is a thing that I was accused of. Most people who listen to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, like it.
Engage.
But as with when any put anything out into the world, some people don't like what you do, and that's fine. So I get my hate. I read an email earlier of somebody who liked the show. I get some angry comments. Somebody referred to my show as corporate bilge, and I thought that should be like your... if you ever turn evil.
If you sell out.
Hey, I worked in the corporate world, so there was definitely a corporate Bilge version of me.
But yes, and I was reminded, because I just read this the other day, and I was thinking about you coming on the show. I'm like, well, there you go. Because your name does have a homonym with negative connotations.
Amazingly enough, my parents were in England when they named me, which I find fascinating.
So they knew they could have avoided it. But it made you. Did you get... has that been a problem over the years, people... thinking that your name meant garbage? I mean,
well, you know, it's funny. As a kid, I thought it was going to be a problem, and it wasn't, because most kids don't know the word bilge.
That's a good point.
Ironically enough, it has been more of a problem as an adult, when you'll get in an argument with somebody, very often, you know, a fellow haughty film nerd, and they'll make some reference to my name. And you know, the bilge bilga thing, and I'm like, oh, well, that's very mature and progressive of you. You know, I mean, very often when I was younger and somebody would make fun of my name and kind of use the bilge formulation, I actually had some respect for them, because it actually meant that they probably had a wider vocabulary than most people I hung out with.
They owned a thesaurus.
Yeah, or they had a boat. Right. You know.
Exactly. All right, well, Bilge, your work can be read on the Village Voice. Thanks again for coming, everybody. Next week's show, for those of you listening, is going to be... Brian, what are we doing next week?
Are we allowed to say that?
Yes. Well, you know what? It's under wraps. It's under wraps. But we'll be talking to you again soon. Until then, everyone, live long and prosper.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.